Whether you're in your smart car avoiding Hummers or you're in your house avoiding the J-Dubs, there's no avoiding us, The Drew Marshall Show, live through our website and right here on Joy 1250.
Well, folks, born and raised in Montreal, John Moore joined Canada's number one talk radio station back in 2003. John also writes for the National Post, and his movie reviews and entertainment commentary were, of course, a staple for years on several Montreal stations, News Talk 1010 and Global Television. He's worked as a director, reporter at the French language CBC for 2 years, and was also one of the founders of the award-winning on-the-spot improv troupe, and has spent years playing reporters and evil lawyers in film and television. And in my very humble opinion, John is easily at the top of the talk radio class. He would probably describe himself as agnostic. As a matter of fact, I think he's actually written that in the Post. However, over the years, he's interviewed numerous prominent faith figures. And today, I think we'll get John's take on faith and spirituality, especially as it pertains to his experience as one of Canada's most prominent broadcasters. Ladies and gentlemen, John Moore. Welcome.
Hi, I feel humbled.
It's quite a build-up. You better live up to it, man.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, John, I guess we should start off with something very poignant. Who does Zach like for tonight's Montreal Philly game?
Well, I'm trying to remember because Zach, my dog, who we ask him to pick every time we go to a new round of the NHL playoffs, we throw balls on the floor and see what he picks up. To be perfectly honest, I forget what he picked up for this series, but I'm crossing my fingers that he showed tremendous fortitude and class and chose the Canadiens.
Well done, of course. Yep. That is just an unbelievable series. It really, what was it, 6-0, then 3-0, and then Montreal came back with an absolute vengeance. I mean, what a storm. The crowd got behind them. It was a tremendous game the other
night. They make you feel like a non-true believer, I guess you could say, because I thought, okay, we're down 2 games. That's it. It's over. It's just going to be a rout. It's going to go in 4. And then I feel really guilty when the Canadiens come roaring back.
It's very Canadian of you.
Yes.
You, I would refer to as a walking thesaurus, maybe on par with the likes of Sting. Did you read his memoir at all?
I didn't, actually. You know what? I have the unfortunate distinction of loving everything that Sting does in recorded music and not wanting to hear a single spoken or written word from him.
Why is that, John?
Because he's incredibly pretentious, yeah. And I think he's a tremendous poet, and I love his music, but even back when he was with the Police, when he would do interviews, I'd think, shut up now, stop trying to undeserve the attention I've given you.
Right. Do you think you'll run for office, politics at all? Because, I mean, think back to those days at West Hill High School, student body president. That's got to carry over something.
You know what, I was one of those guys who grew up, always wanted to be prime minister, and boy, we could probably do an interview just on this topic alone. The closer I've gotten to politics, two things have dissuaded me from ever wanting to run. One of them is it's just a lifestyle that is brutal. I remember John Tory once, back when he was, I think at the time when he was still running to become the leader of the provincial Conservatives, scooped me up one day because he was going by in a van on Yonge Street and said, "Here, I'll give you a lift." And he told me where he was coming from, where he was going to, and where the rest of his day was going to be. And I thought, who wants that? You know, who wants to be stuck in a church basement, in a community hall, and somewhere else? And those are all great and worthy places, but who wants to have 5 of those appointments a day begging people to pay attention to you? The other thing that has sort of discouraged me over the years is just getting closer to government and realizing what a slow and arduous and compromising process it always is. And I just thought, you know, I don't have the patience for that. I get antsy after 15 minutes in a meeting. I can't imagine having meetings all day.
Well, you've just summed that up quite nicely, and I think anybody who's listening who was considering running for office is finished now.
Well, you know what? Politics is full of good and decent people, and something I've tried to do as a talk show host is to make it very clear that I think that there are a lot of well-meaning, and I think there are a lot of well-meaning people in politics, but they're also accomplishing a great deal. So I wouldn't want to dissuade people from considering a career in politics. Just isn't for me.
You know, John Tory is one of those all-around nice guys who I'm glad that he's out. I'm glad he's doing what he's doing. I mean, you guys have a fantastic lineup over there.
Oh, thank you.
I think John's in the right spot at the right time.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I certainly miss afternoons. It was a place I was very comfortable in, but I think to have a guy the stature of John Tory doing talk radio and doing it with us at News Talk 1010 is just fantastic.
John Moore, you and I have a few things in common, so at the risk of creeping you out totally, let's go through them.
Well, as long as it's not that you're living in my basement.
1966, boy, that was a good year, my friend. A very good year.
Year of the fire horse.
Yes. We both have worked on various film sets, albeit you actually had lines, whereas I was a lowly moose wrangler on Welcome to Mooseport and almost got punched twice by Russell Crowe on the set of Cinderella Man.
I think that's a great distinction.
Yeah. Movies you've worked on include, Driven, The Whole Nine Yards,
yep.
And Isn't She Great, which wasn't.
Oh, boy, no, that was a horrible movie. Mm. But you know what? I never really cared. I remember somebody sending me an email early on in my career in radio here in Toronto. And they said, fool, look at the movies you were in. Those are pretty big stinkers. I guess you're pretty ashamed of yourself. And I wrote back and said, tell me the next time you find a job where you spend one day on set, you have a ball, you get free food, you chat with somebody you admire, and they give you $1,000. Get back to me.
And did you have anybody do that, get back to you? No.
No.
You have thousands of dead people behind your house, and growing up, I had thousands of dead people go through my house.
Really?
Yes, I grew up in a funeral home.
How cool is that?
I had a really amazing Halloween party once.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a wonderful Catholic cemetery in back of my house, which is now mostly closed. You get to be buried in the cemetery, and honestly, we have one burial every 2 or 3 years now, only if you are related to somebody and that it was arranged some time ago. So, it's this 29,000 souls in back of my house of good and penitent Catholics, most of them from the 19th century, and I've made a hobby of walking in the cemetery and learning their stories from the stones.
Interesting. I have always said that a great first date is going through the cemetery, reading the epitaphs.
Sure. I mean, you know what? There's something wonderful about trying to divine people's stories, and some of them are very sad, obviously, especially when you go back in time and you have, there are stones in back of my house where it'll be a couple, and they both died in their 40s, and they've got three infants who are buried with them. But it's also extraordinarily humbling because you're walking amongst people who already had their chance. They already had their time. Whatever joys and sorrows they suffered, it's all behind them now. And some of them, have been lying there for 100 and 200 years.
Speaking of already had your chance, you bombed on Jeopardy back in 2006, and I still owe on my 2006 tax return. So that's quite a similarity there.
That's a form of Jeopardy, definitely.
How much did you have to pay them back at the end
of
the day?
Well, you never have to pay them back. As a matter of fact, even if you finish last, they give you $1,000 U.S., But I did it on a lark. I was by myself for a long time when I moved to Toronto, and I got bored. And so a good friend and I would sit there and watch Jeopardy, and then I heard they were having the auditions. So I went to that, and I passed the test, and there were only six of us in the room who passed the test. They give you a quick little run-through on the show with, the kinds of bells they have on the desk at a hotel. That went well, and then finally I was selected, and off I went. And as I wrote in one of my very first columns for the National Post called What I Learned Bombing on Jeopardy, it's a vaguely frightening experience and, extraordinary that all these things that you know, you can't summon. And when there's some smart aleck doctor next to you who's faster on the buzzer, you're finished. So, yeah, I finished so badly in the red that I didn't even get to Final Jeopardy.
What I'm really thankful for is that they didn't publish the scores on Test the Nation when I was on that this past season. It was, here's my deal. With my learning difficulties, when Strombo is reading the question at a verbal pace, my thinking has to stay on pace with whoever's talking out the question. I can't get past that. Mm-hmm. So by the time he finished speaking through the question, it was, there was like 3 seconds left for me to choose.
Yeah, well, this is something I've turned into a corporate speech that I do based on my experience on Jeopardy. And I'm not the first person to use the phrase, but I call it situational thinking. And it's about understanding the context that you're in and having to adjust your brain for it. And I think, for example, that's what makes great athletes is they're able to turn certain things on and turn certain things off in their head. And, if you start panicking, you're finished. It's like the hiccups. It just loops back on itself, and it gets worse and worse and worse.
You played a character named Timothy James in the Growing Pains movie.
Oh, that was awful, wasn't it?
And I'm friends with Candace Cameron.
Oh, well, there you go.
See, we're doing the common thing here.
It's 1 degree of separation, I'm thinking.
And finally, you wrote that really hip and soon to be, a classic pop song, Bieber Fever.
Yeah, that was a fun little thing we did. I mean, Justin Bieber has just gone from 0 to 60 in like 3 months. And Melissa Boyce, who's a wonderful jazz singer who works with us at News Talk 1010, agreed to sing an alternative version of the lyrics. And it was just because I was goofing around. I think I was raking the lawn or something, and I kept humming "You Give Me Fever," and then I kept thinking "You Give Me Bieber." And, we could do something with that.
Wow, I've actually got nothing in common with that one. Sorry, that's the end of the in common segment.
All right.
How will John Moore celebrate his 44th birthday in a couple of weeks?
Very quietly with some friends. Recently put in a new garden, a sort of Japanese Zen Frank Lloyd Wright inspired thing, and I think I'll just have a few friends and a couple of glasses of wine. I'm a bit ambivalent about aging. I think, like everybody, you can't believe where you are in life because you think about where your parents, for example, were at that stage. And, you know, my dad was already raising three kids. I was four when my dad turned 44. But, yeah, you know, I tend to be on the quiet side. The funny thing is that I get paid to talk for a living, but when I'm not actually on the air, I don't talk a great deal at all.
Interesting. I wonder if people knew that about you.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, radio is a very intimate medium, as you would know, and people consider the person on the air to be a friend. So over time, they discover the subtleties of your personality, and I think it's pretty evident because I'm a reader and a cyclist that I can be a bit on the solitary side. So I tend to be a fairly quiet fellow.
I know that your broadcasting career, I think, started at the old CHOM-FM and Hits 990 back in 88, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I started. It was actually with the Chum Group back then, and like almost everybody in radio, started in a job where I was working for free. And worked my way up from there.
If you ended up maybe getting fired from News Talk 1010,
yeah,
maybe even multiple times like Michael Korn, would you ever consider a return to the world of improv?
You know, probably not for a living, but I did recently attend the 20th anniversary of the improv troupe that I founded called On the Spot, and maybe it was because I have not performed improv in 7 years that it was just a sensational evening. I felt really creative. It was very exciting to riff because, I mean, improv is such a different form. It's a form where you have to give and accept and where you have to be open to whatever somebody gives you. You can never say no. I'm very zen when I also do corporate workshops about improv because I think it's a great way to think. It's probably also one of the reasons why things have worked for me on the radio. But also you get a little older and also you have a bit of a public profile. And then you can't run around in a big blue ball gown pretending you're in a Tennessee Williams play anymore.
Well, thanks for that visual.
Yep.
I was recently at the David Shore roast. David Shore was the producer of Monkey Toast.
Right.
And
he's absolutely hilarious.
Yes, he is. He is. He and his wife are moving over to England, and Lisa Merchant was my improv instructor over at Second City.
Yep.
And anyway, it was quite a night. Quite a night. I think you would have enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Toronto has a great, great improv scene. This is where I actually started an improv down on Queen's Quay when I was here, I guess, in 1987 on a stage. I was working at a public relations firm before I graduated from university, and that's where I started out, and that's where I fell in love with improv, and Lisa Merchant was one of the goddesses even back then.
Yeah. Do you think it would have been easier for Walshen to follow Wally Crowder or for you to replace Bill Carroll as the morning man? Because those were two kind of interesting transitions.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to comment on them, to be honest, and it's not sort of a corporate thing. I just don't know. I know that when you follow a legend, for example, Matt Galloway is a wonderful broadcaster and a wonderful guy, and he's, of course, following in the footsteps of Andy Berry.
Hmm.
It's a tough, tough piece of business. With Bill, it was more, I mean, Bill was leaving. He was going off to Los Angeles. And it was also a bit of a change of direction. I think that what Bill's amazing at is getting people riled up. That may not always be the best idea on a morning show. And I think even he didn't feel that, like, he really wanted to open up, and sometimes he had to hold himself back. I think Bill's one of those tremendous kinds of radio personalities that you'll find on any radio station, talk radio, from about 9 until 4. And morning and afternoons are different animals from that.
Well said. Actually, he follows Limbaugh. Doesn't he follow, or does he precede Limbaugh down there?
I think he follows Limbaugh, but yeah. I'm not sure in terms of time zones. But I'm pretty sure the way it works in L.A. is they have a morning show, then Limbaugh, and then Bill lets loose from noon to 2.
Noon to 2, that's right.
Yeah.
I was just down there recently, and boy, he's carrying on, that's for sure.
Oh, sure. I mean, Bill is just one of those great radio talents,
yeah.
And, you know, we were sorry to see him go.
New York City, September 11, 2001. You were there. Where were you, and what the heck happened to you that day? Can you concisely unfold that?
Sure. I wasn't actually there when it happened, but here's what happened that day, and it was a career changer, and things like this happen once in a lifetime to some reporters. I was in Montreal, and I was working actually at that time as an entertainment reporter and a critic, and I was at a point where I was very bored and where I missed the kind of legitimacy and seriousness of the news work that I'd started my career with. I just remember looking up at the screen, and I saw the first plane go in, and then I ran in because our news guy had already gone home. It was an FM station, and I was doing the update, and during that update, the second plane went in to the second tower, and I just thought, you know what, that's it. This is the biggest story of my lifetime, and I sure hope it is. The biggest story of my lifetime, I have to be there. So, you know, there's a much longer story that I've written about and just never published because it's kind of hard. It turned into this insane day. I mean, it would be John's wacky, crazy September 11th while, you know, 3,000 people died.
Yeah.
But I jumped in a car, which ultimately caught fire, and then I hitchhiked and arrived in New York City at the scene at about 9:30 that night. And because of restrictions in terms of people coming and going, and obviously nobody could fly, I was one of the very, very few Canadian reporters to be on the scene.
It must have had a profound impact on you, John.
It did and it didn't. And this is an interesting aspect. I remember when I came home, and I came home on the Friday. I remember it happened on a Tuesday. And I didn't really feel anything tremendously profound. There had been times where I was tremendously moved. I mean, I think the spontaneity of people's responses, it was unique. Nobody had ever been through this before. So where normally now we have a script, you know, somebody drives off the road, we put teddy bears and flowers. Two planes go into two buildings, we don't know what to do. And when I saw things like the pictures going up around New York City, have you seen this man, have you seen this woman, I found that very moving. But when I got home, I didn't feel empty, but I just, I didn't feel that something incredible had happened. And I was watching an interview a few weeks later with Peter Jennings, and he said, you know what, our job is to observe and report, it's not to feel. And, you know, I kind of felt a bit of relief at that point that maybe, you know, it wasn't because I was some soulless person. It was because I had just been doing my job.
Well, for some on that day, they turned heavenward and wept. And,
yep.
And others turned heavenward and shook their fists, and some just finally turned heavenward. Was there any spiritual cathartic thing happening? Has there ever been a spiritually cathartic thing happen in your life?
You know what? I've tried, and I guess I don't think I'm alone in that at all. I still remember when I was going through confirmation. I grew up in the United Church, so, you know, at age 12 and 13, you go through classes with the minister and Bible study, and he introduced us to meditation. And I come from a typical Protestant family. My parents are still religious. They still go to church, but I think my mom thinks of it as a bit of a backstop just in case. My dad's very spiritual and a heavy reader in all of the great philosophers and in the Bible. I used to always wait for something incredible to happen, and nothing would. And as I wrote in a column recently, which was next to, just before Easter during the Passion Week, next to Monsignor Fred Dolan's column, I said, I don't seem to be able to make the leap of faith, and I've never been able to fake it either. So for that reason, I just kind of, I'm not a defiant agnostic. I'm just somebody who's never felt the Spirit move in him.
Okay, so aside from playing a minister and dead awake, what personal experience have you had with God stuff or with religion?
You know what? This is the funny thing. First of all, raised in the church, I know my Bible. I know my Old and New Testament. I can't walk past a church when I'm traveling without going in to check it out. My show, probably more than any other radio show that I know that is not specifically religious, has featured an awful lot of faith issues because I remain tremendously committed to the notion of faith. I guess I'm ready for it. I love meeting faith leaders. We've had some wonderful conversations, you know, Don Miller and Jim Wallace and Anne Graham Lott and people like that. But for me, there's just hasn't been anything spiritual that I know of, and actually, I guess, would say my whole life.
Okay, well, you mentioned that article, and by the way, folks, we are speaking with John Moore, News Talk 1010, extraordinarily gifted broadcaster. Next week, I'll be joined by your good friend, Monsignor Fred Dolan, Vicar of Opus Dei Canada, and I read with great interest your article, which ran alongside of Fred's in the National Post this past Easter. So, a couple of questions from that article.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you agnostic?
Well, I say I'm an agnostic and not an atheist because I was actually part of my education was from Jesuits, so I tend to be very pointy-headed about things. I don't believe I can disprove the existence of God, therefore I have to remain neutral on it and ready to be disproven. I think there's a certain arrogance in being an atheist, and in particular a militant atheist. You know, I find Dawkins to be just as tedious as a lot of people that he's writing against. I say I'm agnostic because who knows? Maybe one day on the road to Damascus, the scales will fall from my eyes.
I guess some of those atheists would call you simply a wimp. They would call all agnostics wimps.
Yeah. They say we can't take a stand. But I challenge people. I know intellectually, if you really want to get serious about it, you can attempt to disprove that God exists. But, you know, I just, I don't, maybe I'm not up to it. up to the challenge of doing so. I just don't believe that intellectually it's defensible to say that you know, all faith is false.
Did you ever come close to full-on buying into the God stuff? Like, was there a moment, just a moment, where you think back on and you think, wow, that was, if I was going to do it, it would have been then?
No, to be honest, no. And again, because I tend to be a fairly pointy-headed guy, I'm also not the kind of guy, if I got cancer tomorrow, I wouldn't start praying. I just have never believed, even when I was a kid, I thought it was kind of odd, and I tried because my parents wanted us to, and then, you know, I stopped going to church, and, you know, it's interesting, spirituality, if you can call it that, remains a fascination of mine, but faith just ain't there.
Father Fred makes a great case for why one might want to believe in the afterlife, but not why it necessarily exists. He says it's illogical to conclude that we are but bones and chemicals. Chemicals can't possibly explain our yearning for eternal life, he writes. True, but a desperate fear of nothingness might. That's a quote from that article in the Post from you. So you have absolutely no fear of death?
Oh, no, I'm terrified of death. I think anybody who doesn't believe in heaven should be mortified of death, literally, because it's the absolute nothingness. And then, you know, I forget, was it Pascal or Nietzsche or whoever said that, you know, if it is nothingness, why fear it? But, yeah, sure, it's terrifying, but not enough so that I can, you know, I'm going to suddenly trump up a false faith.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Larry King and I had a great chat about that. I asked Larry, because it seemed like every time he had Dr. Graham on the show, there seemed to be a death theme, and it did seem like Larry is deathly afraid of death, and I asked him, and he is.
Yeah, Larry's big on death. As a matter of fact, I think it was Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens, who, it doesn't really matter who, but they said that he was becoming America's pallbearer. Every time a celebrity dies, he holds the wake.
Wow. Pascal's Wager is kind of where I've been landing a little bit more in my faith these days, and I've been doing the Jesus thing for 25 years, theological seminary, former pastor, et cetera, et cetera. But boy, you know, is that something palatable to your mindset?
What, to sort of bet just in case?
Yes.
Well, you know what, I'd like to think, and I think I put this in my column, that if I drop dead tomorrow and there is a heaven and I get there, that God's not going to be so picky as to send me to hell with Hitler. You know, I've lived a really good and decent life. I actually think that, you know, if you were, for example, a person who believes in the historical Jesus but not the divine Jesus, that I lead a pretty Christian life. So it would have to be a pretty mean-spirited God not to let somebody who I think has been fairly decent in, just out of, you know, sort of pointy-headed vindictiveness,
yeah.
and you know, the whole there is none but Jesus. I just don't buy into that.
Well, then, according to that description, Tom Harper's in serious trouble. when you look back at your time being taught by the Jesuits, spiritually, what did you learn? I mean, other than how to debate and not argue,
yeah,
for things you can't prove.
Well, and that's the funny thing about the Jesuits, is they tend to be so intellectual that they're somewhat at times lacking in the spiritual side of things. I was taught by some very interesting men. Mostly, for me, it was about the life of the mind, and not about the fact that they were Catholic spiritual leaders. But you know, I find the Jesuits, they can parse anything. I remember calling up one of my old professors to ask him a theological question, and his answer was, "It depends." And I thought, typical Jesuit. I should have called a Baptist.
Well said. When you open up about your agnosticism during your show, John,
mm-hmm,
what kinds of emails do you get from the Jesus people?
You know, good and bad. It sometimes surprises me, and I know this is uncharacteristic, but sometimes you get hate mail from a Christian, and you think, okay, guys, let's get back to the Gospels for a second.
Did someone really email you after June Caldwell's death to say that she had surely gone to hell for her atheism?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and
that's beautiful.
You know, but then I also get people who sort of, I've had a lot of people say that they're praying for me, which is really nice, and that's great.
But does that sound condescending? Does it taste, feel, smell condescending?
It all depends on who it's coming from. You know, I mean, there's every color of faith out there and of practice, and sometimes people can be haters. Sometimes they live in an abject fear of heaven, and they're just hell, and they're trying to protect me from that. I mean, I have to tell you, one of the experiences I had early on when I came to Toronto and I started talking about faith issues on the show and being an agnostic, I had an evangelical preacher send me an email and said, "Listen, let me, you know, I want to take a crack at you. Come and have a coffee with me."
How do you respond to that?
I did, because I'm relentless when it comes to curiosity and learning, and I thought, okay, maybe this guy's going to tell me something. We had a very interesting discussion. We talked about his ministry and his faith and about his family. And I swear to you, a week later, he dropped dead of a heart attack.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just remember thinking, you know, if God wants to bring whatever few hundred thousand years I have every day, owing to the fortunateness of my career, he wants to bring spirituality to the one guy who might be able to talk to those people. He really isn't heading down the right course at the moment. and when stuff like that happens, I think people say God looks after fools and drunks, and I think, well, you'd think maybe he'd send me a sign.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable story. Other than Anne Graham Lotz, Jim Wallis, Don Miller, what other Jesus guests have you had on the show, which you might consider standouts, good or bad?
Well, the author of The Shack is an interesting fellow, although I find that the book is kind of ham-fisted. Jim Wallis really is one of my favorites, though. I think he's a great writer and a great man. And, Anne Graham Lotz, I mean, a lot of the people, because I don't remember a lot of names, but I mentioned some of the people you mentioned because they were the most important ones for me. Anne Graham Lotz, we had a long discussion about her father, and who I think is one of the finest men to have lived in our times. And yet, if there's a God, then God has stricken him with every kind of ailment in his latter life. And it was a very interesting discussion because she's talking about her father and about her faith at the same time and about the fact that, it's not ours to question.
Okay, for the sake of expediency, let's go through this and do the Tiny Talentine thing here. One word to describe. Ready? First word comes to your mind. Ann Coulter.
Harridan.
And here we go with the mind of John Moore.
Actually, I should have said Harpy, but anyway.
Unbelievable. Michael Korn.
Delightful.
You know what I admire the most about Michael? Is he's a father. And I say that because of just over emails. He has said no to things because he chooses to be a father. And
yeah.
I admire anybody that does that. Men.
I just like that he does smart radio and smart television.
Yeah.
And I think he has a very sophisticated faith. And he and I talk about faith issues an awful lot as well. And, I'm always, that's why I have friends who are in the ministry and people like Father Fred. I find faith fascinating, but I guess it remains an intellectual fascination.
Obama,
promising.
Bush?
Loser?
How do you really feel, Sean?
Well, it's tough. Only one word. I'm a guy who tends to string together.
I know. This is the, the bad. Harper?
Enigmatic.
If I was to say to you that, hold on. This probably the most unfair question I've ever asked any guest in the last 7 years is about to come.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think is a better representative of Jesus and Christianity? Who's a better representative of biblical Christianity, Bush or Harper?
Well, having to choose between those, I guess I would easily take Harper, because I think Harper actually, in spite of the book that's out by Marcy MacDonald, I think Harper, whatever his faith is, has not really brought it to bear very much on public administration. He also, he would have gone to war, but I don't think he really, to the extent of George Bush and saying that God told him to go to war against Iraq, I don't think that's how Harper would run a country. So I'd definitely go with Harper.
Marcy MacDonald is up next, right after this interview with John Moore. And, of course, Marcy is the author of the book, The Armageddon Factor. She's coming in your show Tuesday, I think. Is that right?
She is. I'm looking forward to it. I'm reading the book this weekend. I always find it interesting when people, mostly columnists, launch preemptive strikes against a book, and certainly that's been the case in the National Post for the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I get the feeling, and once I finish the book I'll have a more solidified opinion, that she may have sort of 60% of a point. And that's the problem. You have to amp it up when you're going to write a book, so you have to make something out to be a bigger threat than it is. I do think I'm a huge believer in the separation of church and state and in the fact that you can be a faithful person in politics, but do not bring your faith to your policy. I don't believe it's as big a deal in Canada as Marcy MacDonald's made it out in her book, what I've read so far.
Talk radio in the States versus Canada, quite a different scene. It seems like it's certainly more Republican-driven, it's more conservative, the talk radio in the States anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And up here in Canada, which side is sort of more out there? Which side is being represented more?
Well, I mean, there's almost no liberal radio in Canada or U.S. When it comes to talk radio.
Right.
And there's a million reasons why, and that's why I'm writing a book about it. In the States, they actually did an hour-by-hour survey for a month and found that opinion was 93% conservative, and not just conservative, but crazy conservative. In Canada, our conservatism is American liberalism, right? We're very measured. You have people like Charles Adler, Bill Carroll, certainly John Tory, people who come to mind who may lean right but are not nuts. They don't get up in the morning and say, how do I defend everything conservative? How do I paint all liberals as crazy wimps and secularists and anti-religion marauders? So it's very funny. I have an almost weekly segment I do with Charles Adler on Power Play with on CTV, and we almost never clash because I'm a liberal, he's a conservative, but we're both reasonable people who recognize, compromise.
We'll finish with this, John, as a quote from one of your Post articles. I was raised in the United Church, arguably the most secular of Christian sects. In my pre-confirmation interview, I asked my minister why God was such a vengeful control freak in the Old Testament, so grand and meddling in the New, and yet so disengaged with the world today. Even to a 13-year-old, his answer seemed like dissembling. I stopped going to church at 17 and gave up on faith not long after. Boy, you, Bruce Coburn, and myself recount very similar experiences.
Yeah, because I just couldn't wrap my head around what the minister was saying. And maybe this is one of the reasons I have such a high regard for a very intellectual form of faith, which Monsignor Fred can speak to, and definitely Michael Corrin, and even the current Pope. In spite of all his difficulties, he's a brilliant, brilliant intellectual. I just, all the hair splitting and the stuff about, Immaculate Conception is actually Mary and not Jesus, and it goes on and on and on, and I think, can't we all sort of just break it down and be nice to each other? If you follow the teachings of Christ, I think you're doing fine. You don't necessarily have to believe in transubstantiation.
The important question that must be asked and answered is whether one can live a good life without the afterlife. The faithful insist that without the judgment of God, there is anarchy. I would argue that it is a far greater celebration of the nature of man that so many of us choose to be good without the reward of heaven or the punishment of hell, akin to the great majority who behave themselves during a police strike. The notion that without God there is immorality and purposelessness can actually be turned completely on its head. If there is only nothingness after life, does that not then intensify the need to make the most of this existence? If death brings the ultimate void, then surely we must maximize every opportunity for positive experience, connection, and betterment during what limited consciousness we have. Indeed, the absence of an afterlife makes starvation, poverty, genocide, war, cruelty, and indifference all the more abhorrent. It may be better to live in hope than in fear, but no amount of ardent desire will produce an afterlife if it does not exist. In the event I am wrong, I hope God will be merciful. If I am right, neither Father Fred nor I will ever know. Well said, John.
Well, thank you.
Very well said. If you were to deliver the commencement address, say at maybe Tyndale Seminary or Wycliffe College or McMaster Divinity, much like you did at the Vanier graduation ceremony a while ago, what would you say to the soon-to-be clergy?
You know what? Gosh, it's an interesting question. I would certainly rely... I mean, that column that you're quoting from is something I've been toying with for years, and what triggered it was that Father Fred had told me about... he was writing a column, and I wrote him with some remarks, and then he put me in his column, so he sent it to me before he published, and then I wrote back and said, I want to write a column sort of as a counterpoint. And he said, go ahead. It's the Holy Week. I'm going to be forgiving. So it's that's a long-standing theme, everything in that column in my life. And I think I would probably riff on it. And I don't believe that very many seminarians are naturally judgmental anyway, but I would urge people to not judge the good or pure intentions of people merely on the basis of what faith they espouse or whether or not they believe in Jesus. Because I do very much believe that people can live good and decent lives without faith, without prayer, without the belief in heaven, and without the acceptance of Jesus. And while I would love to enjoy all of the joy that it seems to bring a lot of my Christian friends, I seem to be able to get by without it.
I've always appreciated your candor, but your spiritual candor especially, John. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Your time today. Yeah, thank you. John Moore from News Talk 1010. We'll talk again.
Yes, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Folks, that is one of the top guys in talk radio right across Canada. He is on his game. John Moore, host of Moore in the Morning on News Talk 1010. Short break. When we come back, Marcy McDonald, journalist and author of The Armageddon Factor, The Rise of Christian Nationalism in Canada. I've got a few questions for her.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
He's been a guest on CBC's Test the Nation and the Global Comedy Fest in Vancouver.
He's the first Christian radio host invited to speak at the Canadian Association of Broadcasters annual conference.
He's an improv and stand-up comedy student at Second City in Toronto.
He paid an atheist and a pagan to go to church.
And he's known simply as The God Guy on Q107 in Calgary.
After more than 7 years, Drew Marshall is known as the Howard Stern of Christian radio because of his brutal honesty and the fact that he'll interview people others won't.
Like the high priest of the Church of Satan or the leader of Canada's polygamist colony.
He's also interviewed everyone from blues icon B.B. King to television icon Kathy Lee Gifford, from shock rocker Alice Cooper to the godfather of soul James Brown.
And two of Canada's most recognized faces, Don Cherry and Stephen Harper.
Unpredictable.
Provocative.
Genuine.
To book Drew Marshall as a guest speaker or master of ceremonies, go to drewmarshall.ca.